You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
I am here today with my colleague, Leah Palagashvili. It is March 31st, 2026. Leah, thanks for coming on and talking to me.
Thank you, Pete, for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I wanted to start by a little story and then asking you to react to it, because I think you're a perfect illustration of this, which is that when I was a graduate student, there was a Robinson professor here at George Mason University, very famous, named Mary Catherine Batson. She was the daughter of Margaret Mead, the famous anthropologist. And she published a book. I think it came out like right after I left George Mason, but she gave presentations on it while I was here and I attended them. It's called Composing a Life. And what it is it's about an exploration of life as improvisational art form. And she uses women in particular as the practitioners of this improvisational art form. And she uses personal stories of herself and four other women and how they navigated complex, multifaceted aspects of their lives, their careers, their family responsibilities. And her central argument reminds me of your own journey in a lot of ways. And so I was hoping that you might be able to share with us sort of different parts of your own experiences as a student, as a campus organizer, as a professor, both as a scholar and teacher, as a public intellectual in, you know, the New York Times and places like that, as well as now the more modern social media, and as a policy analyst who's testified in front of Congress and had all of that. So, yeah.
And as a new parent.
Yes, of course.
Which is also a big part of your life.
Yeah.
When you're new. Thanks, Pete, for the question. I think I've always resonated with the idea that of life as something you compose rather than follow, and that there are all these. Also, I think you just follow your curiosity, right, in your life. So yeah. If I'm like, oh, I'm really interested in campus organizing, like, why not make that part of who you are? And, you know, focusing on scholarly pursuits, it was just, you know, curiosity, right? And a lot of that came from you, Pete, right? Because I was like, oh, he's asking all these interesting questions. And I want to know, like, why was Soviet Union so terrible? And because I'm from there. Or like, why is it that Armenia was really poor, but the US like rich? So I think it's like, there are many different things in the world that I was curious about. So I just wanted to follow those avenues that I was curious about. And also, like, as a parent too, like, there's so many interesting questions about children and education that I'm curious about. So now I'm like, oh, I'm reading all these books about the brain and child development brain because it's fascinating. And I think that's always been how I was, is like, if I'm curious about something, I want to lean in and then like follow and see where that path takes you. And I think that was part of, and I think the student organizing, you remember me when I was an undergrad and I was organizing the GMU Economic Society, but that's part of like that's because I've always been interested in more of these public engagements, organizing, bringing communities together. So I think that was a part of me. But what was really great about being at George Mason and with you and the other professors that kind of inspired these questions was that then you guys asked the big questions and I wanted to lean in and be like, hold on, this is really interesting because I didn't have this path of like being a scholar or researcher in front of me. It's not what I wanted, but because I was surrounded by all of you who were bringing up these questions, showing interesting frameworks and perspectives. And then I leaned into that and I was like, I'm just going to follow my curiosity. And then bam, all of a sudden I'm the scholar, which was not what I anticipated going in. So I think that's part of it is just that, and maybe that's part of it, what you were thinking too. So instead of seeing these as separate roles, I've always seen them as different ways of exploring parts that you as a person are interested in.
Yeah, it's fascinating you brought up with child rearing and the way that we approach it versus a lot of other people because, yeah, we, you know, we're kind of nerdy types. So like what we do is we go and do like the research, like what's going on with all this. And
yeah, I know way too many papers about like, oh, what's the impact of egg consumption on young children and their brain development.
Is there a, like, do you read Emily Oster a lot?
Yeah.
So you recommend her to other new parents?
Yes. I subscribe to her newsletter, Parent Data.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend her. I know you guys had her out at the Markets and Society conference as well, but I think she's another person who I think is this, you know, she's an economist, studied one thing, and then all of a sudden became this like this model for women who are expecting and have young children. And I even have friends who are not connected at all to academia or economics who follow her.
I gave my daughter-in-law all her books. I have two grandchildren as well. And I think that I didn't get the reaction from Liz like I hoped because she was juggling so many balls and then I'm adding on top of it while she's in school, getting the degree, having a 2-year-old and then having a new infant, you know. And it's like, hey, have you taken time to read this yet? She's like, no. You know, how about you read it for me and tell me, right, kind of thing. But yeah, I think Emily's doing great work for people to have fact-based issues, you know, that to look at, because as you know, in this particular things, there's a lot of emotions and there's a lot of mythologies and all of that. The other thing that I really liked what you just said about that you saw yourself as your own composer. When I was a graduate student, one of the first assignments that Jim Buchanan gave us in class, and I had him my first year in graduate school, was who is the individual in economics? Like, who is this individual that we're actually studying? And he was trying to get us to think about the notion of self-authorship, right? That's like in his natural and artifactual man idea, that we are, in fact, the authors of our own lives. And we need to, like, take on that responsibility. And that also, that responsibility may scare the hell out of us at times, you know, right? But on the other hand, that's what we have to make a free society and all of this. And so those connections, I think this idea of being a composer. So I remember reading the Mary Catherine Batson book and this idea of composing a life. And one of her arguments is that men are not as improvisational because they're able to like have a very linear career path. Many of it's because of child care issues. But, you know, you go to school, you get your job, you know, you try to get your promotions and things like that. Whereas women are forced to have these like punctuated moments. And as a result, they have to think creatively about how they're going to handle all of that. And it gives them an advantage because that's the ultimate thing at the end. Now, I'm probably reading into it, but at the end, I think I remember her claiming women were more interesting than men, you know, precisely because of this. And there is a certain aspect of that, which is quite fascinating,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I think sometimes, well, I don't know if this is related to, I haven't read her book, but with men, you do see them follow this linear path. And I wonder it's because they're more risk averse, right? Because they don't want to take big risks in their careers. It's like, oh, I went to law school. I'm going to get this corporate job because it pays well. And maybe it's part of the expectations that are put where the man has to be the provider so forth. I don't know, you know, with in a marriage and things like that. And so maybe they're less risk averse as well.
Yeah.
Whereas I think like with composing your own life and so forth, you have to be able to like take some risks and be entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And be like, oh, you know what? You know, I went down this path, but it's not really working well. And be able to have the courage to then just be like, I'm going to try something else.
Yeah. So I want to actually, my next question actually relates to that, which is that given the changing demographics, that is the population decline, especially, you know, a younger population and technological innovations, the advancement of AI and other kinds of things, the sort of traditional academic career path that, say, I followed, you know, graduating in the late 1980s and becoming a professor at that time, and then just continuing on the various thing, that was fueled a lot more by both more and more bodies needing to go to school, right? And more and more money being dumped into schools during that period of time. So, you know, what I've seen in terms of even just our school, George Mason. You know, when I started graduate school at George Mason, there was 9,000 students, right? Now it has, you know, over, it's close to like 30 or 40,000 students or something like that. You know, in my lifespan of being an adult, that's happened and it's just exploded. And, you know, it's unclear that that's going to continue, right, in the future because a variety of reasons. So at least it's not going to continue uninterrupted. There's going to be distortions. And I think there's two responses to that. One of them is a kind of a strategic self-defense response. So I build in ways in which I can sort of cover myself from this demographic cliff or this technological, you know, shift. And then there's a more entrepreneurial creative direction, which is that you use that opportunity to see rooms for creative entrepreneurial growth. And to me, you know, this is, I think, given your history and the way you've done it, that you think more in this creative entrepreneurial way rather than this, you know, it goes back to your risk assessment thing, rather than covering for downside risk. It's always more like the other side. And I was wondering if you could maybe share with the listeners some of the examples that you've done as you've moved through and taken different steps, you know, as you went through this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've always approached my career, especially early on, as what I called the startup mindset. And we talked about this, Pete. Yeah. And I think when you're a grad student, also early in your career, the analogy I've given is you're not an established company yet. So you're a startup. And that means you should be taking more risks, not fewer. You should be following one path and then another and then being like, that path is not working, but this one is paying off some dividends. So let's try, or is, you know, has paying off some profit. So let's try this one and so forth. So one example of that was in grad school, was focusing a lot on research, but then would have this opportunity from John Boudreau, who's another professor who was writing this article. He said, look, the Wall Street Journal came to me and they said they want a piece written on the decoupling of wages and productivity since the 1950s. And he's like, do you want to write this with me? And I had like a million other things on my plate. As you know, it's grad school. Yeah. You've got the courses, you've got the exams. We have all of these research projects that I was working on. And I wasn't like a, you know, public until like public writing sort of person at that point. And I was like, let me just try this, right? Like, let's take the risk. It's going to take, I still have to do all these other things I need to do. And so I had to reduce like sleeping that week. But I was like, I'm going to figure out like how to do this. And I think just doing that, just having that opportunity with Don Boudreau into the public writing kind of opened up this new path that I didn't even think was there, that existed. And I loved it. And then that created more and more opportunities because they're like, oh, you wrote this piece in the Wall Street Journal. And then you learned how to write like that. And then it created another opportunity down the road. And so you've kind of, as a startup, built in another like revenue line, profit line, if that makes sense. And so another business line, right? And so I think that's the way I was, you know, that mindset really helped me early on in the career to try to follow these different paths. And then I think as we get older and more established in our careers, just like an established company, as you start to specialize, right? You're like, okay, I'm not going to be this hardcore empirical economist, but I'm going to do this other method that I'm really great at doing, or I'm going to do public writing and policy entrepreneurship and policy influencer, whatever we want to call that sort of angle. And I think that's great. It's part of a natural process where early on you should be open to a bunch of different opportunities and then just kind of see what works, what doesn't, be okay with the failure. So in the startup world, by the way, Pete, they have this concept called fail fast.
Uh-huh.
Right. And it's like, obviously it's an embracing failure, but it's like fail fast, meaning like, oh, I'm going to try this. And if it doesn't work, like I'm going to drop it and move on to the next thing. And so that's what I mean, fail fast. You don't sit there and be like, oh my goodness, like I wrote this terrible paper, right? As a grad student, I'm never going to be an academic researcher again, which I had that opportunity where I wrote a really bad paper and I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And you have a moment where you're like, I'm going to close this off. But it's also like you learn from the failure and you moved on and then you wrote like the next project better and the next paper better. So I think, yeah, I like that mindset. I think and also I will comment on the thing that you said about the defensive approach. So I think the defensive approach is to wait until things are safe or perfectly aligned. But by then you've missed a lot of opportunities. And I've talked to you about this before, but I love the Kersnerian alert to profit opportunities because I use it in this case. So if an opportunity arises, it's not going to, you know, it's not going to stay there forever. So you should jump on that opportunity in the moment and be alert to profit opportunities. In this sense, be alert to different career opportunities that you're presented to. So if I had said no to Don in the moment, because again, I was like, I don't know, 24 or something like that, maybe that opportunity wouldn't have arisen in the future. And then that's a path that I wouldn't have been able to take in that way.
Yeah, there's like these evolutionary adjacent moments. It's because you did that, that then made possible this or whatever. You kind of answered my next question, but I still want to sort of push you a little bit on it in a different way, maybe, which is that, you know, you and I are involved in this organization, Mercatus, that is dedicated to talent identification and cultivation and, you know, platforming and integrating them in the, you know, the talent that we have. You're now doing that with team members in your labor policy group. You know, you're mentoring a lot of young scholars that I think are, you know, quite amazingly impressive, actually. And so you're doing a great job with that. You yourself were a product of this program as well, as I was. And so the way I've always tried to summarize it to people, because I use a sports analogy, I always say that we're trying to identify these five-tool athletes, these five-tool academics. It's an analogy to baseball scouting. A no-miss player for Major League Baseball when they're coming out of high school is one that has scores high on all these five categories. And so they call them a five-tool player. And so I'm always looking that for in academics. And I think of that in terms of, you know, being a scholar, teacher, policy analyst, public intellectual, and a program builder, like, you know, these kind of things, being able to do what you're doing as a director of a program and stuff, or what you did when you were at SUNY Purchase as well, and building up a program like you did with your, you know, Shark Tank kind of initiative or whatever. And so you've already talked about your own approach, which is the betting on yourself and the startup firm, which I think is just brilliant. I never thought about it until I heard you say it. And, you know, and then once you said it, I was like, I can't stop thinking about it. That, you know, basically when you're a young person, you're investing this amount of human capital, you are your startup firm and that's you, right? And you're doing it. It's just a wonderful idea. But now that you've, you know, by the way, this is going to sound strange, you know, now that you've had some experience in life and you're no longer 24-year-old Leah or whatever, if you ran into, you know, say 18-year-old Leah, are there things that you would advise to her that you wish you would have known then that you only know now? Or is it that because of your curiosity, you allowed yourself to be open to these experiences and you feel like you kind of have optimized the arrays around you?
Pete, are you calling me old now?
No, I didn't. Notice I didn't say that. I still remember freshman Leah, so I can't get that image out of my head. So no.
No, that's okay. I'm okay being old and wise now.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so what would I say to 18-year-old Leah? I think it's really important to have resilience early on. That's like a fundamental deal breaker personality / skill trait. And I remember, like, I did have resilience, but I feel like, you know, it took many weeks to get out of something. And so, you know, when we think about, like, we get some sort of bad criticism or negative criticism, then we think, oh no, this is like, we take it personally. Right. And so I remember feeling bad about, like, papers that didn't go well, or being like, I'm not going to be an academic anymore because, like, you know, this is like the worst thing I've written and so forth. And so I think I would tell 18-year-old Leah or other students is, you know, especially in the academic world, if they're pursuing in grad school or PhD, is that you are not your paper. So you can take criticism seriously, but don't take it personally. And that's something I wish I would have told myself more, because I did. There were certainly times where I took a lot of the criticism personally and been like, okay, I need to, maybe I shouldn't be in this world. Maybe I followed the wrong path, right? And so I think that's the fear you have sometimes when you get a lot of negative feedback or criticism, which is essential, right? Because that's part of your development. Like, you need to be challenged. I need to be able to hear that, like, hey, this isn't great, right? And then that pushes me to then make the paper better, right? But I think we can sometimes, again, this is mostly on a personality slash a skill development, which is resilience, is to take it a little too personally and not move on from it. So I have created, by the way, now that I'm old and wise, I've created my 24-hour rule, which is feel bad for 24 hours and then move on.
Yeah, that's a great rule.
In the past, I think it was more like, oh no, like sulking for days and reconsidering the path sometimes too. Right.
Yeah.
And then I think another thing that's hard in grad school, I remember these days, is you've got a lot of like space and free time and you have to self-motivate, right? That I remember being really difficult, right? Because most people who are 24 don't go to, they're not in a PhD program, right? They have to go to work and they have to go to a job that's 9 to 5 and there's structure. And then there's clear expectations. There's a paycheck that comes every 2 weeks. And that doesn't really happen when you're in grad school. And so I think it's really important to have some sort of things that you do to self-motivate. And there was a quote that I always loved. I used to have it actually in my room, like in front of my desk. And it said, now I'm going to forget it, but let me think if I remember it correctly. It's like, they say that motivation doesn't last, but neither does bathing. That's why we recommend it daily. And so a way to like, and I had those quotes where I would try to like look at it every day because I was like, I need to self-motivate because again, you're kind of in this structuralist world where, especially after you finish your courses, where you have to be able to like get in there and be like, I need to like make progress and output today, even though, you know, I don't have to work that day in theory, right? If that makes sense.
I love several of those quotes that you have. And when you were talking, I was thinking about Angela Duckworth's emphasis on grit and how important grit is. I think one of the problems for young people looking at someone like you, all right, or even professors looking back at someone like you, they see this amazing success story. And so as a result, they think that your life has been smooth and continuous and just, you know, always achieving, you know, you get to 30 under 30, then you should get, you know, whatever, every decade, you should get whatever that award is, you know, the rest of your life. And, you know, you should, you know, when you talk up at the White House, they should just say, oh, okay, let's follow Leah's advice because, you know, Leah's told us to do this. And so, you know, the people see that and they see this smooth and, you know, linear progression, but actually along the way, there's been amazing amount of perseverance. There's been amazing amount of grit. And I think that because they see it as smooth and continuous, they underestimate just how tough, you know, you are because of, you know, how hard you've had to have it to be able to make what you want. And you wrote early in your career a lot about Eleanor Ostrom. And she's a great example of that as well. In retrospect, when you were there, did you understand how difficult it was for her to achieve what she is? Or did you see her as just having a linear path?
I saw her as having a linear path, exactly what you just said, right? Because like nobody sees the little failures and you're like every step is like a potential failure, right? And then you do fail. And you're like, oh man, like, you know, this didn't happen this way. And then you have to, what you said, like reinvent or have grit and then try to follow it like something else. Or like, oh, I wrote this paper, but it's not great. Actually, it was a terrible paper. I'm going to rip it apart and like either redo the entire paper or just do a different question, right? Like maybe that was wrong. And I think people, you're right, people don't see that. And I didn't see that about Eleanor Ostrom as well. I get it now when as we're wise and old, maybe or older and wiser.
Yeah.
But I didn't see it at the time. I saw her as having a linear path as well. And probably most everybody else when I was thinking, and that's probably who I was comparing myself to. I was like, oh, I'm not meant for an academic path.
Yeah. Because
look at them doing so great and amazing. And I'm like, yeah. I can't even get like this thing right, an argument right in this one paper sort of thing. So I think that it's a very real, very real experience, especially for grad students. For PhD students. And again, like if you compare yourself to the majority of other people that you know, they're probably in a normal 9-to-5 job, right? Pursuing their careers, doing something else. And so, you know, you might question like, oh, is this the right path and so forth. But I think it's really, like you said, I think it's really important to have that grit.
So I now have some very good phrases from you. Let me sum them up very quickly. So be your own startup firm, right? So you're investing in yourself. In your allocations among your different branches of the investment firm, fail fast, not fail slow. And so you're going to constantly be adapting and adjusting. And then finally, in the academic realm, you are not your paper.
Yes.
I think these are just awesome. They are awesome. I hope that we put them, but I like little phrases too. I don't know if you remember this. I lost this when we moved from Enterprise Hall over to now to Buchanan Hall, but I had for years on my door a fortune cookie phrase, which reminded me of Buchanan. And what it said was, the wise man learns more from the fool than the fool will ever learn from the wise man. And the reason was, is that when I was in class, there was no stupid question in a Buchanan class, because a question would be asked that the rest of us thought was stupid, and Buchanan would turn it into a genius question in the way he would do it. And that did two things. One of them was, it didn't devastate the student, all right? And it elevated the conversation in the classroom. So I was always amazed by this, because the contrast, and I'm not dissing him, but was to Tulloch. And in Tulloch, what you had was, even if you answered a brilliant answer, he would find a way to destroy it, because, you know, that was his method, was to destroy. It was like intellectual jujitsu with him, and he wanted to see if you could survive the assault. And that was a totally different strategy. And it had the two of them, and going back and forth, it was like, you know, intellectual ping pong, right? Like, which one, how do you answer to each one of these? But I had that phrase for years, because I thought it summed up. So I really like these phrases that you have. Especially the one, you are not your paper, because so much of our job is to write arguments that are subject to contestation that then get attacked. And that's the only way they can get better. So,
and I have a story for you, Pete, actually, on another quote that you gave me, but it has a fun story to it. It's a quote that you gave me that I used to have hanging up on my wall too. It's the worst thing that can happen to a good cause is not to be skillfully attacked, but to be ineptly defended.
Yeah.
And do you remember the story of that quote?
I'm going to tell you the story to that quote, because I remember it like it was yesterday. You were an undergraduate, and I said, I cannot find the source of this quote, and I'll give, I don't know how much I offered, but I offered some money if someone would be able to find it. And you found it in literally 5 minutes, and I had spent a month looking for it. So just user
that's
failure on the
Kersnerian alert to profit opportunity.
Yeah, I remember it. It was unbelievable. I couldn't believe it that you answered me so fast, and there it was. So,
well, I was like, I'm an undergrad. This is $100. I'm going to find a way to find the quotes.
That's awesome. I wanted to maybe switch gears a little bit and talk about your own research. I mean, I'm sure that most of the people listening know about the work that you're doing right now on the gig economy. And I don't want you to short shift that. I definitely want to talk about that, because I think that's such a, just to praise you for a second on that, I think that is such a vital aspect of the entrepreneurial opportunity economy. And it's one of the ways that we can address this issue of rigidities in our current labor markets, right? Because one of the things that we've seen, like Casey Mulligan laid out in the redistribution recession years ago, is that our labor markets have become more gummy than they used to be. And as a result, people can't get on the bottom of the economic ladder to climb up the economic ladder. And offering this alternative where you're not having to go through the standard, you know, rules and regulations of the labor market might end up by being freeing up. So I want to really have you drill down a little bit on that at the end of this question. But what I wanted to ask you about was actually some of the stuff that you did earlier on theory and application, because you studied self-governance and development economics. You contributed to the field of law and economics, right? You have studied political economy and political, you're editing. Like, when is that due out, by the way? It's a major book.
Summer in July, we're editing the handbook on classical liberalism.
Yeah. So maybe tell us a little bit about that. And then also, you know, finally to this issue of the entrepreneurial society, which you've taken from a variety of different angles, because not only did you do the gig economy, let's say, you know, Uber and Lyft or whatever, but now you've also talked about the portability of, you know, benefits and flexibility in labor markets. So if you could maybe talk about some of the buckets that you've made investments in over the years, that would be really valuable.
Well, that's a great question, Pete, but I want to highlight mentors for creating some, because when you're an early grad student, I didn't know where to start. And like working with you, I got the self-governance buckets and institutional analysis bucket. And then like moving forward. And I think that's like the, what is the phrase? Like teach a man to fish and he'll never be hungry.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So like, I think that's the greatness of good mentors like you is that you teach the man to fish. So you're not like giving me the buckets. You're not being like, now here's some food. Here's some food. Like where if you're doing it right, like you did with me, you're teaching me how to find the buckets, right? And invest in, and like do the research. And I think that's a really, really important trait to learn is like, how do you, oh, I'm working on the self-governance and I've got this institutional analysis framework. How do I apply that in these different buckets, right? And so I think that's like you giving me the teach the man to fish and you'll never
that.
Be hungry again, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think that was that's the most important thing is in grad school with you and our program is I learned really well the framework and different ways to apply the framework and many different ways to think about trade-offs and perspective and so forth. And then that becomes really easy to apply because as you used to say, look out the window, right? That was one of your quotes, like, what are you interested in? Look out the window. And so then you look out the window and then you see a question or an interesting thing and then you apply the framework or the lens because you used to say put on your economic eyeglasses and then you can see that thing in depth and make it and really fascinating. And so the gig economy question, you know, someone who's not wearing an economist or institutional analysis, comparative analysis framework, right, whatever different lenses, Austrian framework, whatever different lenses that we have, they're going to be looking at these workers as, oh my God, they're in this terrible jobs that they only work a couple hours a week and they don't pay a lot and there's no benefits, there's no security, and they're not going to see the truth sort of thing. And they're not going to see the thing in all of its dimension if they're not wearing some sort of framework and perspective and glasses to analyze what's going on. Whereas when we look at it, we're like, oh, this is really interesting. This worker chose, right, and to work in this gig economy space. Why did he choose to do that? what were the choices that he was faced with that he ended up going to the gig economy or self-employment bucket, whatever it is? And I'll give you a little context and story too, because when my parents first moved to the United States, I was 7 years old, right? But they moved here with basically zero language, no transferable degrees, right? Nothing of that sort. And so they're not going to be like candidate number one at whatever Microsoft, whatever company is hiring, or they're not even going to be candidate number one at Walmart, right? Because you need to speak the language and so forth. And so you need to be put yourself in the shoes of those people who are choosing and who are working in these different jobs. And so my dad and my mom, for example, they started off working as self-employed. My dad was a construction worker. That was his first job, right? And then you like slowly like build up, you learn the language and you get skilled and so forth. And so I think people have this like framework where they're thinking is gig job as like your career, right? And a lot of times, by the way, there's that perspective about minimum wage jobs as well. They're like, oh, this is a minimum wage career. But for most people, minimum wage jobs are not their careers, right? Like I worked a minimum wage job when I was a high school student. And then like you move on and you build up and that sort of thing. And so I think it's really important to understand, one, the choices that people have when they go into these jobs. It is like, again, my parents are not, you know, applicant number one to be considered at Microsoft, right? Or at Walmart. So they had to find these careers and these jobs as a stepping stone to build skills, to learn, and then they move up over time, right? And so that's really important perspective. And that's a different, by the way, that's one side of the self-employment, gig economy, independent contractor side. The other angle, which is what the data is actually showing about Uber and Lyft and DoorDash drivers, is that the majority of them actually have W-2 jobs, right? And so they're literally doing this as a, you know, after 5 p.m. or on the weekend thing. And then again, you want to put yourself in their shoes. Do they want another W-2 job? Probably not. That's why they're doing their gig economy job, right? So DoorDash data, for example, if you look at it, 90% of Dashers work less than 10 hours a week. That's not your full-time job. That's your gig. And then when you look at the data on when they work, they're working after 5 p.m., so evenings and weekends. So they're truly treating it as a gig. And in that perspective, it's like a value added for that person because they have their 9 to 5 p.m. job. They want to meet their financial goals and needs and so forth. So they pick up the side job. And again, if you don't have the lens and the framework and the perspective to kind of look at the situation in all of its dimensions and angles, you're going to look at that worker and be like, oh, wow, they're in this like vulnerable position and this is terrible for them. It's like, but you haven't even asked. Do they have a full-time job already? What else is going on? Do they have health insurance through their full-time W-2 job? And so I think that's why it's really important to really like internalize and understand the different lenses and toolkits and frameworks that you have, because then you're able to look at a situation and be like, you know, what else is going on here?
I'm just going to tell you that, you know, one of the things I think a lot of people might not do enough of is talk to the Uber drivers, actually. So it's funny because what you were just saying, I was just in Charleston, South Carolina, and one of my Uber drivers couldn't speak English. She actually used her Apple iPhone constantly to use AI to translate and then talk back to us and everything like that. But she had just moved to the country and like she was driving Uber to, you know, get the beginning of things, right? And another time I was in Phoenix and the Uber driver was a golf pro. He was trying to get his on the circuit. So what he would do is like, because I had bags that I had to put in the back of his trunk. You know, because I was going to the airport and he was like all upset because we had to move his golf bag out of the way like that, you know, so to be able to do it. And he's talking to me and this is what he's trying to do. He's trying to be a golf pro. So he's trying to like make, you know, get in tournaments and things like that. He's just starting out. He was your 22-year-old, like you're talking about. He probably didn't have the sponsorship that he was hoping to have. And so this was his way to try to pursue his dream, you know. And then my wife and I were also in Uber in Charleston. And it was a retiree that took us around. You know, he picked us up and he said, no, I retired to Charleston. I do this to pick up some extra money. And then he laughed and he said, I have very strict limits. For example, I stop because they get flexibility when they can stop, right? He goes, I refuse to pick up any college kids after 10 o'clock at night because I don't want to be stuck with like drunk college kids. You know, I'm a retiree. I don't have time for that. And I was amazed at like the flexibility and what they each had is a little bit of, you know, I don't want to romanticize it. I'm just, you know, it's like, this is what they're doing. It's their choice. Going back to your, you know, composing or authorship, this is their authorship kind of idea. But let me like ask you a little bit about, so can you just say very briefly about what you're trying to do with the flexible benefits stuff? Because I think that's having, you know, you're able to get a nice platform for that stuff. Whether it gets accepted or not is a different question, but yeah.
Yeah. So the idea of, I made up a little phrase for it, flexible benefits for a flexible workforce.
Yeah.
Although it's called portable benefits right now. Okay. So I'm going to show you the big vision thing and then what we're doing as well. So as you know, in economics research, the coupling of benefits to a job, to W-2 job, has been shown by a bunch of different economists as creating all these labor market mobility issues, a lot of inefficiencies. I think even like Jonathan Gruber, right, who's head of MIT, that was his whole research portfolio, is showing that the employer-sponsored health subsidy connected to employment has actually done a lot of damage and bad outcomes to the U.S. labor market and so forth.
He just has a different solution than you.
Yeah, he has a different solution. but we both see the problem, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's good.
Identify the problem was like the benefits are stuck with the job, right? To a W-2 job. It's very specific, right? To a W-2 job. And so the sort of like North Star is for the vision of labor market dynamism is to decouple benefits from employment. What we're working on now is a small stepping stone on that, which is like, first, how do we get benefits to independent workers that are portable? Then once we figure out this portability question of benefits, then we can think the 10 or 20 year question of how do we make benefits and labor markets a bit more efficient, better labor market dynamism. And labor market dynamism is really important for the things that are going on in our world right now, right? We need to have labor markets that are resilient to technological shock, AI, right? And other shocks as well, right? But the tech shock is going to be a big one. So having dynamic labor markets is a way to have resilience for our labor market economy. So the independent worker portable benefits, flexible benefits workforce is a small puzzle piece in that kind of bigger picture about decoupling benefits from employment and getting stronger labor markets that are more dynamic and more resilient to shocks. The specific thing here that's going on here, Pete, is that currently if you hire a freelancer, graphic designer, or whoever it is, and if you wanted to be like, I'm going to give, 90% of your income as cash and 10% into a benefits account that you can hold, maybe it's tax advantage, maybe it's not, whatever. You can't currently do that. Because if you did that, then IRS and state regulators and the government will come after Pete and be like, well, Pete, you just misclassified your freelance graphic designer. You hired her for the last 20 years. You're gonna have to pay back fines and fees and penalties and for misclassifying this worker. And so that sort of voluntary arrangement between a worker and a client or a company can't occur. And it's both bad for the business, right? But it's also bad for the worker because that worker, the independent worker who's self-employed, doesn't have this sort of thinking about infrastructure for benefits, for savings. There's no I guess the word is infrastructure. There's no infrastructure in the same way that you would as a regular worker or W-2 employee. And so what we're trying to create is the ability, right, to have for independent workers, gig workers, self-employed workers to have that infrastructure where they can put money in if they want to, right? It's all volunteer. And if the company or client wants to put money in on their behalf as well, they should be able to do so as well as part of it. In the same way that you as a W-2 employee or worker can have that arrangement with your employer. It's pretty simple. So I call it legalized access to benefits for independent workers. And there's no like the reason I love this idea and the reason I think it's taken off is because there's no like real downside. Like I'm not mandating Pete Bettke to give benefits to his freelance graphic designer who he hires, for 5 hours a month, right? Sort of thing. It's just that if it's a voluntary arrangement that benefits both parties, they should be able to do that. And we're talking, and the other reason this is important is because policymakers and others are already starting to see the trend that we talked about or a little bit earlier, we alluded to it, which is that a lot of younger people are going more into self-employment and entrepreneurial careers than older generations in their same age group. So right now, if you look at some of the surveys, they're like, oh, I'm not applying for an entry-level job. I'm going to go and start my YouTube channel, right? Or I'm going to go and do this other thing and pursue self-employment opportunities. So that workforce is going to keep growing. I actually think it's going to keep growing because of AI as well, because I think AI is going to be what I call a transaction cost shock, right? This is another framework, right, that we learned in grad school that I'm applying to this thing, to AI shock. So I think that's going to increase more people going into self-employment, sort of having these small startup-y solo self-employed businesses because they can use the tools of AI as a complementary, basically, instead of relying on teams of workers and employees at a company to produce kind of to do the copy editing, you can rely on AI potentially and things like that. So I think that makes it more important. And actually, we were talking to this Democratic policymaker from Nevada reached out a month ago because she said she's mentoring young people. And she noticed that a bunch of these young people are not applying to jobs, like normal jobs, but they're going into entrepreneurial endeavors, self-employment, gig work, and so forth. And she was interested in the portal benefits policy solution as a way to help those workers and empower those workers. And so that's part of the reason I think we're seeing it take off is because, again, it's a low-hanging fruit solution. There's no real downsides. It's legalizing access to benefits for independent workers, allowing for these voluntary arrangements to occur. And then the other reason is I think people are seeing the handwriting on the wall, which is this: the self-employment is going to continue to grow.
Yeah, the way I read your stuff is that you're trying, it relates to your transaction cost point. You're trying to find ways in this new idea when we take this reduced transaction cost that allows us to have a greater scale and scope for the entrepreneurial society. So you might have argued like in the 1950s or whatever, you got organizational individuals, right? You went and worked in a corporation, you were tied to all of that. And now it might be the case that the transaction costs of being an entrepreneurial economy in great scope might have been very high at that time. And now what we're doing is we're finding ways to lower it so we can have more and more of this kind of activity that can go on. And a large part of it is precisely because you can do many parts of the supply chain can have transaction costs reduced because of technology.
Yeah. Yeah. That you said it better than I did, but that's my argument.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's great. I have a question for you because you're very good at phrases, right? And so how much time and effort have you devoted to like the rhetoric of the argument? Like, you know, the way you said that I need flexible, you know, benefits in order to have a flexible economy or labor market or whatever. Like, how much time and effort have you done in your thinking about your writing, not your writing itself, but then the thinking about the writing to the rhetoric that you've developed in talking to people? And how did you learn that in your experience of talking to these different audiences, like in Washington, D.C., or to corporations or whatever? Yeah.
Yeah. And I also developed the legalized access to portal benefits because, like, you can't argue with legalizing access to benefits, right?
Yes. Yeah.
I think it's really important. I think if you're doing something new, and I think if it's slightly complicated and complex, because when we first started talking about this, I'm like, oh, benefits for independent contractors. I'm like, why do independent contractors need benefits? Like, they're self-employed, they're sole entrepreneurs. Like, what are you talking about? What is portal benefits? That's the number one question we get, right? Was like, what do you mean by portal benefits? Like, where does the benefit stay at? Like, does it not stay with the company? Where would it exist? And so because there's a lot of complexity in a new kind of in this new idea, it's new, right? It's not like we're doing something that, you know, people have heard about for the last 50 years, right? So then you do have to devote time, and we did devote. And part of it is just the fail fast, right? I've had really bad conversations with people and I was like, okay, that didn't land well.
Yeah.
Right. And I was like, we need to rethink that. That didn't land well. And it's still happening now. Like I was in DC a couple weeks ago and 9 out of 10 of the conversations I had were really great. Fantastic. Cause we were talking to policymakers, we're explaining the research behind it, we're explaining the ideas. But I had one where like it just was not landing. Right. And I was like, it's not happening. It's not going very well. But that's a learning opportunity too, still. And you might say, like, you know, it's better when you start early on because you're failing a lot, so you're learning a lot. Yeah. And so in the beginning when we were talking about this, and this is, again, like 7 years ago, a lot of the stuff wasn't landing well, right? And especially like terms like calling people like workers gig workers. It's like they're not always gig workers. Gig workers is a subset of the self-employed and independent workforce because like a construction worker is an independent contractor, but he wouldn't think about himself as a gig worker, right? And so that was a learning experience as well with like rhetoric where I'm like, okay, talking, but this isn't landing well. So I would say like 7 years ago, I was probably learning a lot more and developing the framework because we were seeing a lot more failures, fail fast, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, had this conversation. It was not great. It didn't land well. Like, and then we have to like rethink and be like, okay, you know, what's the new phrase and flexible benefits for a flexible workforce? I can't remember how I came up with that, but I think it was through multiple conversations. But also I love when I see a quote, I just like save it in a note.
Yeah, I think Mercatus actually has had some pretty good ones. I think that the pathologies of privilege is a very good phrase. I think permissionless innovation is another one, which is a great phrase.
mainline economics.
Yeah, that hasn't always landed as well as it was hoped to land. But I really do like the flexible benefits for a flexible labor force or whatever. I think that's great. I have one last question. I'm mindful of your time, so I'm just going to ask you one last question, which is, so besides your little ones, what keeps you up at night at the moment and that you cannot sleep about, you have to wake up to think about, but then in the morning, you can't wait to wake up to think about it. So what's the most curious thing going on at the moment?
Okay. It's a deep thing.
Okay.
But you're probably the best person to talk to about this. Okay. So I'm thinking about the tension that you have between having a vision for how the world should work, but making sure that I'm not seeing evidence that confirms that vision.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Because do you know what I mean, Pete? Because it's
we're the easiest person for us to fool is ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So because I think we all need some kind of framework. We just spent, this whole conversation talking about the importance of frameworks and perspective because it helps us make sense of complex systems and, even decide which questions are worth asking in the first place. But at the same time, I wonder, does that framework can quietly shape how we interpret what we're seeing, including which evidence we find more persuasive or not? And so I'm trying to think about, anyway, that's something that literally keeps me up at night. Cause I was like, how do I square that tension, right? Because perspective and vision of how the world should be and so forth has always been my guiding light. But then I'm like, am I falling to confirmation bias? And how do I make sure that I'm not falling to confirmation bias? Do you see what I mean?
No, it's 100%. It's one of the questions that you're not there yet. But Robert Nozick, the philosopher, used to say that sometimes the best philosophy can only happen when you have gray on your temples. you're not there yet. It's a great question, which is, how do I make sure that I'm not fooling myself and constantly asking what arguments or evidence would persuade me to the opposite position?
Yeah. And like, you're not reinforcing a story you believe. And I think because I've studied the gig economy, independent worker stuff so much, I might see a piece of evidence and think like, oh, this is really great. It confirms what I already think, but that evidence might be like bad, right? And so I'm like, how do I hold it lightly enough so that I'm still open to updating it?
Yeah, no, that's a great piece of advice to young scholars is that, there's a, one of the key things is to not allow your eyeglasses to be completely rose colored, right? So you want to use the eyeglasses, but they can be distortionary as well as they can be, illuminating. And so how is it that I ensure that I'm not getting the distortion and instead I'm getting, the more illuminated reading? I'm not sure that there's a scientific answer to that as much as an art. And self-discipline. Yeah. It's an attitude that you have. There's a Richard Feynman, the great physicist, used to say the following thing, which I think leads us to this, which is, don't ever fear asking a question which you can't answer, but always run away from answers that can't be questioned. And so if in your peer group, people are putting forth arguments that can't ever be questioned, you should maybe say like, like, I'm not so sure that's working. But if on the other hand, they're willing to weigh the other side of an argument and, allow the other side to talk and listen and then disagree with it. And for fact, sometimes, vociferously disagree with it, but nevertheless, they're giving it a fair hearing, right? Then you kind of know as a third party looking at it, okay, that's the right attitude to take. Obviously all of us have some degree of success or failure because we all suffer from, these biases of confirmation and, cognitive dissonance and all kinds of things like that.
You know why it made me think of it too? Because I think many years ago, you probably don't remember, you gave me, was it Daniel Dennett's book?
Yes, on the rules of engagement. Yeah,
something like that. And it came up in there where there was that quote, and you used to say this quote too, which is, if all you have is a hammer, then everything begins to look like a nail. And he had that quote in there in the book. He used it. And so I actually still have the book on my bookshelf and I was looking at it couple months ago. And I was like, oh, this is a really great read because it makes you want, like, makes you think that you need to be a bit more just like thoughtful and careful. And I want to apply it to myself with the work that I'm doing because I'm so in it that I'm like, maybe I'm not seeing something and I need to push, I need to like light, hold it a little bit more lightly and step back a little bit to make sure I'm not missing, you know, some evidence and other things that I would be missing.
Well, Leah, I want to thank you so much for taking the time here. You are a great example to all of our current students and future students about what they can do with their economic education as long as they allow curiosity and commitment to guide them. So thank you very much and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Pete. And thank you for being a mentor to me. So
I appreciate
it's because
that.
Because of you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.